It is good to be with you all again. In the United States, we've been fooling ourselves for a very long time. We've been asleep. We have come to, as they say, believe our own press. The proof of this is the myths we have perpetuated from the beginning of our nation. And the first myth to examine is that of American exceptionalism. You know, the actual phrase American exceptionalism was originally coined by Soviet leader Joseph Stalin in 1929. According to Wikipedia, the term over time has come to represent three related terms, or three related ideas. The first is that the history of the United States is inherently different from that of other nations. In this view, American exceptionalism stems from the development of a uniquely American ideology based on liberty, equality before the law, individual responsibility, republicanism, representative democracy, and laissez-faire economics. This ideology itself is often referred to in the modern sense as American exceptionalism. The second is the idea that we have a unique mission to transform the world. As Abraham Lincoln stated in the Gettysburg Address in 1863, Americans have a duty to ensure, quote, government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And the third is the sense that our history and mission gives us a superiority over other nations. For example, American intervention on the world stage has claimed a superior moral purpose of acting altruistically in defense of freedom and democracy. You know, Lincoln's admonishment found roots in earlier thinking, which ultimately led to genocide. Manifest destiny is one of those things. That genocide was founded on the idea that the indigenous people living in the United States deserve to be conquered because. A host of reasons emerged over time. And chief among them was that the indigenous people actually did not own their land. White Americans needed the land for expansion. So they felt that indigenous people did not deserve that land and needed to be civilized. The central reason for the brutality of displacement and genocide on the part of white settlers and the American government that supported them is simple racism. It should not be forgotten that the United States during most of that time was a nation that legalized human slavery. And this is important to remember in order to understand the mindset of the people then. You know, even if they themselves did not personally own slaves, or even if they did not agree with slavery, that peculiar institution was a part of their lives. The West, especially in the 1850s, could be a rough place to live. Public hangings were common. Institutional brutality based on race was normalized. So let's skip ahead 50 years, past the Civil War that freed the slaves and the Plessy versus Ferguson decision that ensured another 80 years of Jim Crow virtual enslavement, and we arrive at the myth of integration. We all know what the goals of integration were: to tear down the Jim Crow laws that separated black and white races, starting with efforts in the late 1940s to establish the racial equality dreamed of by civil rights movement. Well, I hate to inform you people who've been dreaming for the past 60 years, the goal of integrating our society is an abject failure. Skip ahead another 60 years, past the 1960s, past the Obama presidency, and we now exist in an era dominated by the myth of colorblindness. In his book entitled Social Inequality and Social Stratification in U.S. Society, Christopher Doob writes that colorblind racism represents whites' assertions that we are living in a world where racial privilege no longer exists, but their behavior supports racialized structures and practices. We've all heard the fruit of this vision of white supremacy as articulated by the likes of Mitch McConnell that President Obama's election is proof that we live in a post-racial, colorblind America. This myth of colorblindness is a beautiful weapon for white supremacists. It ignores the fact that for the first half of the 20th century, it was completely legal to deny blacks and other racial minorities access to housing, jobs, voting, and other rights based explicitly on race. The civil rights reforms of the 1960s rendered those practices illegal, but these inequities, of course, are still with us. They're within living memories of many people like myself. The laws barring practices that previously maintained racial inequality, like redlining, segregation, or openly refusing to rent or sell real estate to Black Americans, have changed minds, but not hearts. So discrimination still persists, operating through a combination of social, economic, institutional practices that are called institutional or systemic racism. And this is where many sociologists have warned us of the extreme dangers of colored blindness as an ideology. They argue that as the mechanisms that reproduce racial inequality have become more covert and obscure than they were during the era of open legal segregation, the language of explicit racism has given way to a discourse of colorblindness. But they fear that the refusal to take public note of race actually allows people to ignore manifestations of persistent discrimination. And in this age of colorblindness, Michelle Alexander informs us we are experiencing a new Jim Crow to suppress the votes of African Americans, people of color, and to remove them from our economy by incarcerating them by the millions. This perpetual state of affairs has been engineered in perpetuity by lifetime judicial appointments being made by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So by practicing this colorblind racism, the new Jim Crow manifests itself through lifetime appointments of this Southern Republican Senate Majority Leader. He and his Senate friends are using their power to perpetuate white rule, beginning with his vow to, quote, oppose everything Obama. That included obstructing many of his judicial appointments, of which the theft of Merrick Garland appointment to the Supreme Court is being the most blatant. A national slumber about race has brought us to the moment where we are now. And that moment feels like we've been here before, doesn't it? The 1920s saw race riots in this country. The 1960s saw race riots in this country. The 1990s saw race riots in this country. And now, in 2020, right on schedule, we see race riots in this country. Why? Because we've never addressed our dark secret with anything other than legislation and some goodwill. We have not changed both minds and hearts. At this moment, white America apparently has no idea why black people are protesting, and yes, even rioting in the streets. And here's a newsflash. It is because the refusal to take public notice of racial inequalities has allowed us to fall asleep and ignore manifestations of persistent discrimination. The reasons why statues are being torn down and Confederate flags are being burned is because some white people are beginning to see with new eyes. They see their own faces in the face of Eric Chauvin and wonder with horror how he became their monster. In America, we people of color have seen those statues, those flags. We have heard the fine words, the empty promises, and have experienced the insides of prisons from an entirely different perspective. We know the monster. We've lived with it for centuries. It is all the insults, the laws, the overt and microaggressions, and the institutions meant to be the knee that grinds us down into the pavement. A while ago, I awoke to the sound of my wife reciting the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of a teleconference meeting. And when she said the words, "One nation under God, with liberty and justice for all," they hit me like a bolt of lightning. I had a profound sense of grief because I realized those words are simply not true. We're not one nation. We are a confederacy of white supremacy for a tenuous majority. And there's another nation for essential workers and people deemed to be useless feeders with a permanent chip on their shoulders. We are a nation with freedom of movement, freedom from suspicion, freedom of economic opportunity, freedom to manage our affairs, and freedom from fear of a brutal police state. But then there's another nation that is simply not so free. And finally, there's a nation where the lady with the scales of justice is white, and the weights on that scale are much lighter for white men and women than they are for people of color. My grief and profound sadness was generated by the realization that I do not live in one nation under God with liberty and justice for all. Now we arrive at the final myth, the myth of the individual. In America, we like to believe that our ideals apply equally to all. We live in an exceptional country where the ideology of equality before the law, individual responsibility, and representative democracy is a way of life. Our grand experiment to create the world's best model of a melting pot is a raging success. People in this nation have been integrated into a cohesive, mostly functional body. There's no such thing as racial inequality because we live in a colorblind society. The reality is we live in this roiling mess called the United States of America. In our defense, we're not like other nations. We are exceptional in the way that we actually are a kind of melting pot. In other nations, without the legacy of slavery or colonization, and with homogeneous populations, can go about improving the lives of their citizens based on the principles of equality. But we do not have that luxury. People of color are screaming in the streets. White America must awaken from its slumber, or our country will be ripped apart at the seams of race. So how do we do this? How do we wake up? How do we pay for our colossal moral failures? I believe we need to look at our Constitution and Declaration of Independence, realizing they were written by old, white, aristocratic, hypocritical, racist men. But I propose that we mash those fine words up to create a new creed that makes sense for us today. And it would go something like this. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, hold certain truths to be self-evident. Among those truths is that all humanity belongs to one family descended from the African continent, that we are all children of our Mother Earth, that we are inextricably linked to one and each other and to our planet, that justice for all beings is essential to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that all beings are equally endowed with unalienable rights. I made that up. To move forward, we must recognize that the concept of race is a scientifically meaningless construct invented in the 16th century, mainly to justify slavery for economic reasons. Racism is injected into the DNA of our nation from its inception, and it's haunted our legacy. The central principle to work with now is that we can dismantle racism from the inside out by acknowledging that its effects are both damaging and persistent. So from this place of acknowledgement, we can move forward. But to do that, we must correct our past errors that have disabled people of color. through meaningful remedial reparations. We have to teach the true history of white supremacy in our country without the salves of lies that ease the cognitive dissonance generated by genocide and racism. We must change everything about our nation, from how we're governed, to how we're educated, to how and where we build houses, to how our businesses are operated, to how we police ourselves, to how we administer justice, to how we treat each other, to how our children interact with each other, to how we worship, to how we care for our planet, to how we behave towards other nations and people of the earth. In conclusion, we dare not go back to sleep with the comfortable dreams of our myths. Our slumber has been wrecked by reality. Now we need the courage to arise and fully grasp hold of a better world. We've run out of time to do this. Namaste.